hello, hello. Here's Marlanka again with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, Essays, Divine and Human. Starting on page 13. God in his entire being is unknowable. The scientist thinks he has corrected the mistakes of the metaphysician because he refuses to deal with anything but a narrow and limited circle of facts and condemns everything else as hallucination, imposture, and imagination. His parti pris, his fierce and settled prejudgments, his determined begging of the question are too obvious and well known to need particular illustration. He forgets that all experiences are facts, that ideas are facts, that subjective knowledge is the one fact of which he can be decently sure, and that he knows nothing even of the material world by his senses, but only by the use of his subjective knowledge makes of the senses. Many a materialist will tell you that only those facts can be accepted as a basis to knowledge which the senses supply. A position which no man can substantiate and which his science daily denies in practice. These reasoners consent to trust to their sovereign subjective instrument when it settles for them the truths about this world visible to their lower instruments. But the same sovereign instrument is condemned as wholly fallacious and insane when it deals in precisely the same way with another field of perceptions and experiences. When my subjective experience tells him, "I'm hungry," he consents. "Of course, you must be, since you say so." But let it tell him, "I am full of bliss from an immaterial source," or "by certain higher instruments repeatedly tested, I know that I have wandered in regions illuminated by no material sun." And he answers, "You are only fit for the jail or the lunatic asylum." No one has seen the earth whirling round the sun. Indeed, we see daily the opposite. Yet he holds the first opinion obstinately. But if you say, "Although God is not seen of men, yet he exists," he turns from you angrily and stalks into his laboratory. The practical man avoids error by refusing to think at all. His method at least cannot be right. It is not right even for the practical uses he prefers exclusively to all others. You see him stumbling into some pit because he refuses to walk with a light, and then accusing adverse circumstances or his evil fortune, or he shouts, elbows, jostles, tumbles, and stumbles himself into a final success and departs at last satisfied, leaving behind a name in history and a legacy of falsehood, evil, and suffering to unborn generations. The method of the practical man is the shortest and most facile, but the least admirable of all. Now, truth is an infinitely complex reality, and he has the best chance of arriving nearest to it who most recognizes but is not daunted by its infinite complexity. We must look at the whole thought tangle, fact, emotion, idea, truth beyond idea, conclusion, contradiction, modification, ideal, practice, possibility, impossibility, which must be yet attempted, and keeping the soul calm and the eye clear in this mighty flux and gurge of the world, seek everywhere for some word of harmony, not forgetting immediate in ultimate truth, nor ultimate in immediate, but giving each its due place and portion in the infinite purpose. Now, some minds, like Plato's, Vivekananda, feel more than others this mighty complexity and give voice to it. They pour out thought in torrents or in rich and majestic streams. They are not logically careful of consistency. They cannot build up any coherent yet comprehensive systems, but they quicken men's minds and liberate them from religious, philosophic, and scientific dogma and tradition. They leave the world not surer, but freer than when they entered it. Some men seek to find the truth by imaginative perception. It is a good instrument, like logic, but like logic, it breaks down before it reaches the goal. Neither ought to be allowed to do more than take us some way and then leave us. Others think that a fine judgment can arrive at the true balance. One does for a time. But the next generation upsets that fine balancing, consenting to a coarser test or demanding a finer. And the religious prefer inspiration. But inspiration is like the lightning, brilliantly illuminating only a given reach of country and leaving the rest in darkness, intensified by the sharpness of that light. And vast is our error if we mistake that bit of country for the whole universe. Is there then no instrument of knowledge that can give us the heart of truth and provide us with the key word of existence? I think there is. But the evolution of mankind at large yet falls far short of it. Their highest tread only on the border of that illumination. After all, pure intellect carries us very high. But neither the scorner of pure intellectual ideation nor its fanatic and devotee can attain to the knowledge in which not only the senses reflect, or the mind thinks about things, but the ideal faculty directly knows them. Now, some men sneer at the cities because they do not believe in them. Others, because they think it is noble and spiritual to despise them. Both attitudes proceed from ignorance. It is true that to some natures the rule of omne ignotum pro magnifico holds, and everything that is beyond their knowledge is readily accepted as true marvel and miracle. And of such a temper are the credulous made. It is also true that to others it is omne ignotum pro falso, and they cannot forbear ridiculing as fraud or pitiable superstition everything that is outside the reach of their philosophy. This is the temper of the incredulous. But the true temper is to be neither credulous nor incredulous, but calmly and patiently to inquire. Let the inquiry be scrupulous, but also scrupulously fair on both sides. Some think it shows superior rationality, even when they inquire, to be severe. And by that, they mean to seize at every opportunity of disproving the phenomenon offered to their attention. Such an attitude is good rather for limiting knowledge than increasing it. If it saves us from some errors of assertion, it betrays us into many errors of negation and postpones developments of the utmost importance to our human advance. I do not wish to argue the question of the existence or non-existence of yogic siddhis, for it is not with me a question of debate or of belief, disbelief, since I know by daily experience that they exist. Rather, I am concerned rather with their exact nature and utility. Here one is met by the now fashionable habit, among people presuming to be Vedantic and spiritual, of a denunciation and holy horror of the yogic siddhis. They are, it seems, tantric, dangerous, immoral, delusive as conjuring tricks, a stumbling block in the path of the soul's liberation. Swami Vivekananda did much to encourage this attitude by his eagerness to avoid all mention of them at the outset of his mission in order not to startle the incredulity of the Europeans. "These things are true," he said, "but let them lie hidden." And now, many who have not the motives of Vivekananda think that they can ape his spiritual greatness by imitating his limitations. There was no such weakness in the robust temperament of our forefathers. Our great rishis of old did not cry out upon siddhis, but recognized them as a part, though not the most important part, of yogic accomplishment, and used them with an abundant and unhesitating vigor. They are recognized in our sacred books, formerly included in yoga by so devotional a Purana as the Bhagavad, noted, and some of their processes carefully tabled by Patanjali. Even in the midnight of the Kali, great siddhas and saints have used them more sparingly, but with power and effectiveness. It would be difficult for many of them to do otherwise than use the siddhis, since by the very fact of their spiritual elevation, these powers have become not exceptional movements, but the ordinary processes of their thought and action. It's by the use of the siddhis that the siddhas, sitting on the mountains, help the world out of the heart of their solitude and silence. Jesus Christ made the use of the siddhis a prominent feature of his pure, noble, and spiritual life. Nor did he hesitate to communicate them to his disciples. The laying of hands, the healing of the sick, the ashirvada, the abhishapa, the speaking with many tongues were all given to them. The day of Pentecost is still kept holy by the Christian Church. And Joan of Arc used her siddhis to liberate France. Socrates had his siddhis, some of them of a very material nature. Men of great genius are usually born with some of them and use them unconsciously. Even in natures far below the power and clarity of genius, we see their occasional or irregular operation. The West, always avid of knowledge, is struggling, sadly hampered by misuse, imposture, to develop them, and gropes roughly for the truth about them in the phenomena of hypnotism, clairvoyance, telepathy, vouched for by men and women of great intellectuality and sincerity. Returning eastwards, where only their right practice has been understood, the lives of our saints, northern and southern, are full of the record of siddhis. Sri Ramakrishna, whose authority is quoted against them, not only made inward use of them, but manifested them with no inconsiderable frequency in his Leela. Well, I see nothing in this long record immoral, dangerous, or frivolous. But because Europe looks with scorn and incredulity on these miracles and this magic, we too must needs be ashamed of them, hustle them into the background, and plead that only a few charlatans and followers of false paths profess their use. But as for us, we are men of intellect and spirituality, ascetics, devotees, self-deniers, Vedantins. For these things we are too high, and we leave them to theosophists, immoral tantrics, and deluded pseudo-yogins. Let us have done with cant and pretension in all matters. There are no such things as miracles in this world of divine processes. For either there is no such thing as a miracle, or, if we consider more closely, everything in this world is a miracle. And with that thought, with those words, we close for today, and we shall continue in the next episode. So come back and hear some more. Thank you for listening, and may the light and wisdom of the words of Sri Aurobindo enter you and lead you to more light. Bye-bye for now.
This is Auroville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.